Okay, so as part of the Howard Zinn Memorial Lecture Series, we're honored to have Fred Magdoff here today. He taught at the University of Vermont in Burlington. He's the director of the Monthly Review Foundation, the journal started by Paul Sweezy, the Independent Socialist Magazine in 1949. And he's a frequent contributor on issues of political economy and Marxian ecology. He is the author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism, which Naomi Klein called a relentlessly persuasive book, together with John Bellamy Foster, and also together with John Bellamy Foster, The Great Financial Crisis, about which Emmanuel Wallerstein of Yale said, "If you want a clear and cogent explanation of the reality of our debt crisis and what might be done about it, this is your book." So, Fred Magdoff has been working in the tradition of Marx and Keynes, and the tradition inherited from Paul Sweezy and Harry Magdoff and Paul Barron, seeking sort of to have a radical to formulate a radical critique of capitalism that shows us, especially in regard to what we're talking about today, with the problems with the environment and Wall Street, that we have to sort of confront capitalism to really solve these problems and start building a democratic socialism. So, without further ado,
Fred Magdoff.
Well, it's certainly a pleasure to be here. I was at Wall Street last Sunday, which was exciting. Yesterday, I was at Occupy Burlington, which is just getting organized. They slept overnight. The first night was Friday night. Saturday morning, you'd be interested to know the farmers market was operating right there in the same square, and the farmers gave them $400 worth of tokens to be able to buy food for the Occupy Burlington movement from the farmers. So, you all know there's lots happening in different places. What I was going to do today was talk around the theme of a book that has just come out, myself and John Bellamy Foster, which is called What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism. There's a copy of that book, which I brought for your library, as well as a book on the ABCs of the economic crisis, some other issues of Monthly Review, the magazine. So, if you'd like to see them, they're copies in your library here. So, I was supposed to talk last night, and because of the weather, it was suggested that maybe I better come down from Vermont today instead of yesterday. I think it was probably a good suggestion. Well, let me just talk briefly about capitalism, then I want to talk about the environment in a little bit more detail. First off, I mean, what's the purpose of capitalism? It's not to provide the basic needs of everybody. It provides the needs certainly for some people. It's not to produce jobs for everyone, although it certainly does as it operates, produce jobs for a certain number of people. It's certainly not to protect the environment. There is only one purpose to the economic system that we live under, and that is to produce profits, and to produce more and more profits. That's the driving force of the system. It's why capitalists invest their money. That's the whole purpose to the system. So, as the ecologist Richard Levins has said, who teaches at Harvard said, agriculture is not about producing food, but about profit. Food is a side effect. Health service is a commodity. Health is a side byproduct. So, we have a system here which is really designed not to satisfy people's needs for work and for satisfaction of their basic needs, but rather to produce profits. Okay, so capitalism is really good at two things. One thing it's really good at is accumulating capital. That's the whole point of capital, is to get more and more profits, and it accumulates and accumulates and accumulates in relatively few hands. The other thing that capitalism is really good at, and that is producing crises. And we're now living through a number of crises at this point. There is the economic crisis, which you're all well aware of, and it's probably the major motivating force, I assume, behind the Occupy movement. but there certainly are the other crises as warfare and imperialism goes on. And there is the crisis that I'm going to talk about this evening, the environmental crisis, where we have a tremendous number of problems going on around the world, of which global warming is maybe, or climate change is maybe the one that needs the most attention now, but it's certainly not the only one. Our water and air is being poisoned. We ourselves are being poisoned with food, with the water that we drink, with the air that we breathe in. There are many other environmental crises as well, the degradation of land and the acidification of the oceans, etc., etc. So we have with us a crisis which many people are aware of. And the book that I wrote with John Foster was really written with people who are concerned about the environment in mind. And there are some relatively sophisticated environmentalists who understand that there is a problem with this system. And they understand that there are two major problems. That this system keeps growing, except when it's in recession. But even now, by the way, it's growing. You know, the economy has been growing since June of 2009. Not fast enough to produce enough jobs to employ everybody, but it has been growing. But these people understand that as capitalism grows, I mean, as the system grows, it uses up renewable and non-renewable resources, and the renewable ones sometimes even faster than they can be replenished. And it creates a whole atmosphere of consumerism to encourage people to buy more and more stuff so that the system keeps going. The other thing that they understand is that there are these side effects which are quite negative. And that is the environmental side effects as well as the social side effects to the system. So there are many environmentalists who understand this. But what they say is basically, and I'll come back to this in a few minutes, is that, you know, we can tinker with the system. We can do this and we can do that, and we can have a green capitalism. But I maintain that really that is impossible, that there can be no such thing as green capitalism, because capitalism as a system has to grow. If it doesn't grow, it's in crisis. When we're growing at 1% or 2% as we are growing right now, this year, it's not growing fast enough to employ everybody, to create the jobs. We have fewer people working today than we had 10 years ago. And we have about 10 to 15 more million more people of working age. And so we need that many more jobs in addition to the 14 million that are, you know, unemployed, et cetera, et cetera. So that we have a real problem. And if we were to grow at 3%, which is not all that great, we'd have a doubling of the economy in 24 years if it grew at 3% for 24 years. So it's a system that has to grow. It's impelled to grow. Individual capitalists have to grow, or they're going to get eaten up by some other guy down over here who's growing and is going to take their market share. So there is there really is an impulse for the individual to grow, individual capitalist, and there's an impulse for the whole system to grow. If it's not growing, we have problems with employment. If it is growing, we have problems with the environment. And so it's more and more and more, not that we don't have problems with the environment even when it's not growing. So this is a system which really has no way of solving these problems. The damages that occur, some economists refer to these, you'll hear this, as externalities. They say, well, the pollution of the air, that's an externality. They mean that something that happens during a business practice, production, let's say, that is not paid for. And they don't account for it in any way. So it's external to the company. All right, everybody with me on that? But I would say that these really are internalities in the sense that they are internal to the workings of the system. The companies don't pay for them, so who pays for them? The environment pays for them, and we pay for them with dirty air, dirty water, dirty soil, etc. So that these are really part of the way the system functions, is not to pay for the full costs. As I think it was David Harvey said, if capitalists were forced to pay for the full cost of everything they did, they would go bankrupt. And we use the example in the book of coal, which is the cheapest form of energy to produce electricity, cheaper than oil, than natural gas, than nuclear, etc. And coal, I've forgotten what it was like $5 per million BTU in the summer of 2010 to produce electricity. But that doesn't count for the destruction of the mountaintops. It doesn't count for the methane going into the atmosphere. It doesn't count for the workers who are killed. It doesn't count for the workers who get black lung disease later. It doesn't count for the mercury that goes into the ocean. So all of these costs are unpaid. They're not part of the system of accounting. So there are people who say, well, we can try to find a new soul for capitalism. We can try to change corporate charters. We can do all sorts of things. We can produce green products, and all you have to do is just buy more stuff. That's okay, as long as it's green stuff, then that's all right. But the problem is, if you have a system in which you have to produce more and more, even if it's so-called green, you have an environmental disaster that's going to happen. So what is the alternative? I would say the only way that you can really have a no-growth economy, and that is after you've taken care of the basic needs of everyone, is to have the decisions, the economic decisions, under social control. That is, under control of the people. In other words, a real economic and political democracy, where people make decisions about the economy, about what to invest in, instead of that being done by private corporations. And the economy then has to be at the service of the people. Right now, we are at the service of the economy. But in a different type of a system, in a socialist system, or a socialized system, the economy would be at the service of the people, and it would be directed to providing the essential needs for everyone. It would be aimed at trying to create substantive equality. I don't think you can have an ecological system without it being basically equal. It would take the environment into account in all decision-making processes, and the economic and political decisions would have to be made by the people at the appropriate levels. How do we go about doing that? Well, just let me give you an example in Venezuela. In Venezuela, you have community councils where the communities get together. These are like 300 to 400 families. Cities are divided up into communities. Even rural areas are divided up into communities. And they make decisions about what they consider to be their highest priorities. They have a ranking system. Each community decides this. This is for infrastructure I'm talking about now. Do we need a new school? Do we need a new clinic? Do we need a paved road? Do we need to get water to houses because we don't have running water, electricity, etc.? They rank them, and the government, that's all based on oil money, of course. That's where the government of Venezuela is getting its money. But the government then gives money to the communities and the expertise. There's a lot of volunteer labor, and these communities then actually create what it is they need. I visited a community where the women just got tired of lugging water, and they wanted to put in a water line to bring water from a main into the community and to hook it up to their houses. And they were taught how to do it. They dug the ditches themselves, they laid the pipes themselves, they hooked it up to their houses themselves, and they created the water system for themselves. This is just an example. This is an example of how you do it at a community level. Now, the question is, somebody has to give you the money. You have to have control of the resources. That's the whole point. If the resources are in the hands of private control, communities can't do this. If resources are at the disposal of the community and made at the disposal of the community and the region and the multi-region, then you have the opportunity of actually making these decisions and carrying them out. And this is how it can be done. So there are ways to do it. But the point I'm making is, A, you can't do it. There is no way to do it within the system that we currently have. If we're going to leave money in the hands of private individuals and in the hands of corporations and have them make the decisions about how to invest the money, the decisions are going to be made on how they can make the most money on their investment. That is the purpose of why they make the investment. So it has to be an alternative system. Okay, I better quit because it's cold and it's late, and if I'd just soon have a conversation if people have questions that they would like to ask or comments they would like to make. Also happy to talk about the economy and financialization or any other issues as well. Yes. About co-housing or cooperative housing for homeless? Yeah, no, I think cooperative housing in general is a great idea. We should have a system where there are no homeless, where there's no such thing, where there are no hungry. Here we have, I've spent a good part of my professional career working in agriculture, okay, on soils and plants. So let me talk just about food in the United States. Here we produce more food than they know what to do with. And they want to export it, and they want to process it, and do this and do that to it. And yet we have 46 million people receiving food assistance. We have some quarter of our children in the United States living in households that are considered to be food insecure. Many of those households, is somebody in the house who will skip a meal so that others in that house can eat. Usually we're talking many times about a woman, a single woman with kids, and she will skip a meal in order for her kids to be able to have three meals a day. She'll only have two. So this is not uncommon. How can this be in a country where we have so much food? How can it be where we have so many resources? And now we have all these houses that are empty out there. How can it be they're tearing down these houses? Why don't we have people in those houses? Why don't we put them in? There is no explanation aside from that the economy is designed not to satisfy people's needs. It's designed to satisfy the needs to make profit of people who have money. It's called greed. Yes. That it definitely is. Anything else about there's so much about the environment. This is a very pressing issue. It is, I think, one that I've only seen a few signs at the Occupy movement, but one of them was certainly a good one that deals with the environment. But one said, and I'm sure the quote came from someone else, this woman was carrying a sign that she had made, infinite growth is not possible on a finite planet. And that is certainly the case. And we are in the process of destroying the planet. We're in the process of making the planet very difficult for people to live in. The effects are already being felt in parts of the Mekong Delta in Vietnam because of seawater rise. The level of the sea is coming up now, and you have intrusion of salt water into the rice paddy areas. You have people displaced because of these huge floods that they've had in Pakistan. You've had many, many different environmental problems. I visited Bolivia twice last year, and the mountain glaciers are melting as they are in the Himalayas. And those are basically their reservoirs. They store water during the colder season and release water gently during the drier and warmer season. And so you have communities that are actually starting to run out of water for irrigation, for crops, and actually for drinking water. So this whole issue of climate change is not something for the far future. It's happening right now, and it's having effects. I visited, what's that?
Colorado River and Reed Lake.
Yes. Absolutely, long-term droughts in the southeast. And when I was in Bolivia at the climate change conference in April 2010, there were many people represented from the United States, from different climate justice movements, Native American movements, and there was a fellow there from the Intertribal Council of Alaska, and he told about himself helping to move a village that had to move inland because of sea level rise and the melting of the permafrost. I said, you actually helped to do it yourself? He says, yeah. He said, we got a bunch of people together and we moved the whole village because they couldn't stay there any longer. It was just turning into mud, and it was, and the whole thing was sinking because the permanent frozen ground was not permanently frozen anymore. So these are issues that are actually happening right now. This is not for the far future. Rice yields declining in Asia. because of high nighttime temperatures, corn yields declining in Africa because of high temperatures. So climate change is not an issue to think about, oh, this may happen in 10, 20, 30 years. Yes, it's going to get worse, but the effects are already being felt. And of course, they're much, much worse for the poorer people living in the poorer countries of the world. Anything else? Yeah.
Can you talk about the military-industrial complex as a tool for propping up capitalism?
The military-industrial complex is as a tool for propping up capitalism. Yes, it's definitely one of the more important tools that is used. It's what are we doing in the Middle East? As somebody said, if they grew carrots, in Iraq, and they had no oil, there would have never been a war in Iraq, right? I mean, there's no way to conceive of that war without the geostrategic importance of the Middle East and of Iraq in particular. And it's not just oil, it's the gas and it's the pipelines that might go through it. Afghanistan also, it's the same issue. So, yes, I mean, this is, the spending on military has been a very important part of keeping our economy going. And a part of the imperial strategy has been to try to control key resources around the world. And one of those key resources, of course, is oil. And that has been, basically one of the major moving forces of the U.S. policy since after World War II, really. And we overthrew the president of Iran and installed the Shah. And the British oil companies were more or less supplanted by American oil companies in Iran after that happened in 1956, if I'm not mistaken, or 54, in the mid-50s. Anything else?
Over
here,
Fred.
Yeah. Either way.
Yeah. Sir, since you have this strong background in agriculture, I'd like to ask you about one of our favorite companies, Monsanto. You probably have known people who work in Monsanto, or you probably know a hell of a lot more about it than many of us do. How is it possible for people who have some modicum of intelligence and who have know something about agriculture themselves to do things that are, frankly, screwing all of us?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I happen not to know anyone who worked in Monsanto, but that's an example. Here you have, what are these guys doing? You know, there are many people who believe that these seeds that Monsanto and these other genetic companies are producing, that these seeds actually increase yields or somehow have some benefits for people. They don't. The whole purpose of what these guys have done, I'm talking about Monsanto, have been to produce, basically, I mean, what are they in it for? They're in it to make money. So what are the good points of these seeds? The good points of these BT corn and the BT cotton and the Roundup Ready soybeans and corn, etc. These are resistant to herbicides, so you can pour on this particular herbicide, or they resist bugs. The whole point of these is basically to simplify the agricultural system. Why are farmers buying these seeds? Because it allows them to farm on larger acreage in a more simplified system than they would have to do otherwise. So Monsanto is able to sell the seeds not because the farmers are getting better yields, but because the farmers are able to simplify the system, makes it easier for them, and they can farm larger acreages. So it's all based on a profit issue. There is no particular need for these whatsoever. As a matter of fact, you get into trouble using them. There are major problems with weeds that have become resistant to Roundup. And so what Monsanto says is, well, you farmers, you guys just didn't do it right. And in 5 years, we're going to have a new variety for you, which is going to be resistant to another herbicide, and you can buy that other herbicide. So it's a lousy technology the way it's being used. I can't speak for the people who are actually developing it because I don't know them. I'm sure there's some way that they justify it, that they're doing something to help agriculture. But what they're really helping is a tremendous, tremendous profit-making center that these genetic seeds have become for the Monsantos of the world, of which there are only three or four. Anything else about, yeah?
Agriculture question.
Yes.
I've been hearing talk at the United Nations that one of the ways we're going to feed the burgeoning population of this planet is by more efficiency in food production and food delivery. Like 40% more efficiency, so we're not going to waste any food, and that's going to make a difference. But in light of what you're saying about profit motive, which is already in place, I'm just wondering if you can reflect with me about where you see waste that would stop happening so that more people would get to eat, or just more about the agricultural necessities of food for people, not profit.
Well, there's tremendous amount of waste that occurs. If you're interested, by the way, there's a book that myself and Brian Tokar, many of you may know Brian, an environmentalist and from Vermont, we edited a book called Agriculture and Food in Crisis. It's also a monthly review press book. It came out almost a year ago. And basically, there's enough food right now being produced to feed everybody in the world, not just in the United States. That includes Haiti, that includes Africa. It includes, India, et cetera, where people are committing suicide on a regular basis, farmers because they've gone into debt, and people are literally starving. So right now there's plenty of food being produced. What's the problem? One of the problems is some of that is being diverted to other uses than food. Because basically, poor people, in order to have effective demand. What economists call effective demand means you got money. If you got money, you got effective demand. Poor people don't have effective demand. Do they have a need for food? Of course they have a need for food, but they don't have the money to buy it on the market. If you're poor enough, you don't. And so what happens is potential food